While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some time from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the radio news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Good afternoon, Namibia, and thank you for tuning in to On The Reader News Analysis. Welcome to Eagle FM, the home of conversations. I'm your host, Andafa Happy Juju, and you are currently tuned into On The Reader News Analysis, your weekday deep dive into the issues shaping Namibia's economic, social, and governance landscape. Today is Wednesday, the 6th of May, 2026, and as we move through the week, we turn our focus to the stories and developments shaping the national conversations right now. Now, on the Reading News Analysis this afternoon, we dig into the issues that matter most, from economic trends and policy decisions to social dynamics and governance challenges. What's driving the headlines? What does it mean for you? And where is the country headed to next? Here, we don't just tell you what's happening. We unpack why it matters, how it affects you, and what it means for the country's future. This is where headlines meet context and where clarity and accountability remain at the center of the conversation. Now, every weekday from 1300 hours to 1430, we go deeper, bringing you expert insights, informed analysis, and archived sound, and of course your voice in the discussion, because in an age of fast moving information, real understanding does take time. Now you can catch On The Reading News Analysis live across all Eagle FM frequencies, stream us via the Eagle FM website, or download the Eagle FM app, or stay connected through our WhatsApp channel for exclusive updates and content. So wherever you're listening from, whether you're at work or at home, stay with us, stay engaged, and stay informed. Because right here on The Reader, we interrogate the issues where Namibia doesn't just listen, but also comes to think. Let's get right into today's stories. Namibia moves to finalize long-awaited food safety bill over a decade. Now, the Ministry of Health and Social Services has convened a high-level stakeholder consultative meeting in Windhoek as part of renewed efforts to finalize the long-awaited food safety bill, a piece of legislation that has remained in draft for more than a decade. Now, the two-day engagement taking place at Avani Hotel and Casino from the 6th to the 7th of May 2026 brings together policymakers, health experts, and industry players to refine a law aimed at overhauling Namibia's food safety framework. Now, the proposed legislation seeks to introduce a comprehensive system to regulate food safety across the entire supply chain, from production and processing to importation, export, and sale. It will also repeal the outdated Foodstuffs, Cosmetics, and Disinfectants Ordinance, replacing it with a modern framework aligned to current public health and international standards. At its core, the Food Safety Bill is designed to enhance that all food and drinking water in Namibia is safe and suitable for consumption, strengthen inspection systems and enforce compliance across the food industry, improve traceability mechanisms to enable rapid and effective food recalls, especially in an event whereby something is detected within the food, should be able to be relatively easy for them. That is when the bill comes into effect, as you have also seen in South Africa. Events of such are happening, and also towards the regions of Kavango East and West, where we often hear about food poisoning. Also, regulate both imported and exported food in order to meet health and international trade standards, and provide accurate food labeling and information to protect consumers from misleading practices, and as well as to establish a dedicated food safety council and a panel of ministers to oversee implementation. Now, the bill also targets risks related to primary production, including pesticide use and animal feed safety. And this matters because health experts says the urgency of the bill lies in its potential to address rising food-related health concerns, and thus include food-borne illnesses such as diarrheal diseases and parasitic infections, as well as non-communicable diseases like diabetes and hypertension, obesity, and certain cancers, all of which are increasingly linked to dietary patterns and food quality. Now, beyond public health, the bill is also seen as a critical for economic growth by enhancing or by ensuring that Namibian food products meet international standard or safety requirements. The country can protect and expand its access to global markets because it puts it in a position where it meets the standard, and therefore there should be no challenges as to why it can compete on the global stage. Now, after more than 10 years in development, stakeholders say the current consultations could mark a turning point in getting the bill over the line. And it is scheduled, the Ministry of Health and Social Services is foreseeing it to be implemented at least for the 2026-2027 financial year. And if passed, the Food Safety Bill is expected to significantly strengthen Namibia's food systems, improving public health outcomes and enhancing consumer protection, as well as positioning the country to compete more effectively in international food trade. Now, the engagement is being attended overseen by the Ministry of Health and Social Services, and also has environmental health specialists also on board, having to discuss and give their opinions concerning the consultative bill. Now, with that being said, let's take a listen to Executive Director in the Ministry of Health and Social Services, that is being Mr. Penda Ithindi, on what he said at the opening ceremony of this consultative bill. Let's take a listen.
It recognizes that ensuring food safety is not a responsibility of a single institution. We all recognize that. And it is a shared obligation, and that requires coordinated action by all of us, coordinated action by the organizations that we represent. It is a shared obligation which requires strong partnerships. As we realize that in today's world, unless we gear ourselves to achieve the ambitious sustainable development goals, no single country, no single organization is able to achieve the broader objectives without support from the other. So the scale and the quantity of resources that are required to do so would require strong partnerships. And it requires meaningful engagement across the interconnected sectors. In fact, we have adopted a One Health policy. Most of the organizations, if not all, that are represented in this room have contributed to the making of the country, of our One Health policy, which commits all of us as stakeholders to plan together and to act together across the interrelated nexuses to achieve better public health outcomes for all. So this coordination is particularly important, and the bill is only a relevant piece of legislation if it addresses the core issues of the country. It takes into account the context, the local context, the international context, best practices regionally and internationally, but must address the core issues that are relevant to Namibia. And this is why we are all here, to ensure that we make that contribution to the making of this legislation. And one day when it's passed, and that day should not be too far from today, we should all be proud to have contributed to that piece of legislation that is unlocking opportunities in the food space. So I like Anafsa when she said that she's a humongous contribution to make, and to make those relevant contributions so that we have a practical bill that is relevant to the needs of the country, responsive to the needs of the country, and adaptable. Today's workshop marks a significant milestone in the journey of drafting the food safety bill. As you may recall, the draft bill was first submitted to the Cabinet Committee on Legislation in 2017. And Program Director Gabriel just indicated that the work started way back in 2014 or so. Notice that that is a decade ago, more than a decade ago. And we are still in consultation. While we know that some progress has been made since then, including stakeholder consultations that took place prior to today, obviously you can agree with me that it's not justifiable to be drafting a bill for more than a decade. What it means is that all the developmental intentions, all the good propositions that we are proposing to be covered in the bill, all the gaps that we have noted, all those, the developmental intention that would be encapsulated in the amendments that we make and the proposals that we make, their impact will not be felt until the bill is implemented. Their impact and the developmental ambitions and unlocking opportunities, by the way, for the food systems development, unlocking opportunities for businesses, agro-businesses, agribusinesses in the food sector, all those good intentions will not become manifest until such time that the bill is put into implementation. So quite obviously, to be in the drafting stage for over a decade is a trajectory that we would want to end here and now, and to move forward with speed and renewed enthusiasm for us to refine and to finalize this bill. This bill, from the ministry's perspective, must be on the legislative calendar of Parliament for this financial year. So we must therefore move with speed, the necessary speed, the necessary comprehensiveness, and the necessary detail for us to get the job done. Ladies and gentlemen, we are at the time when the food systems across the world and the region are facing increasing complex and evolving challenges. Emerging food safety threats such as the rise of foodborne diseases, antimicrobial resistance, the impact of climate change and the variability on food production, contamination from environmental pollutants, and the growing complexity of the global and the regional food supply chains, global trade, place greater pressure on national regulatory systems. These regulatory systems have to be adaptive to this dynamic environment and at the same time to enable business and trade while ensuring that public health and food safety issues are not compromised. In Namibia, we are not immune to these risks. We know very well as a small, open economy with a high degree of openness, a small open economy that is still dependent on trade for food and food products. Our legislation has to be that robust, must look at how best it enables the country's productive capacity so that we boost our food security and food sovereignty. The language that I've been speaking almost 3 years ago at the Ministry of Agriculture. How do we fortify our food systems? How do we enable productive capacity where we have competitive advantage? Because we cannot talk of productive capacity at all costs if we do not have that comparatively competitive advantage. But where we do have, we should be able to do that. This bill summons us, the draft bill summons us to look at the whole value chain and how we enable conditions and create enabling conditions for us to produce, for us to preserve, for us to process, and for us to trade. The bill should not introduce impediments to these processes and chain effects, but should be an enabling framework that ensures that there is, of course, safety and public health safety are not compromised. It is within this context that this the food safety bill becomes not just a regulatory instrument, but a catalyst for change, a catalyst for productive capacity, a catalyst to enable businesses, agribusinesses to thrive, but a catalyst also to ensure that public food safety and public health issues are not compromised. The bill seeks to strengthen coordination among competent authorities. As you go through, and I trust you, we have an opportunity to go through the various sections of the bill, make inputs thereof. That's where the likes of Stanley would be facilitating to lay bare and advocate them to lay bare the main provisions that are being proposed and for your structured input that would enter into the bill. So to enhance resilience, surveillance and inspection systems to promote science-based decision making. It introduces a more integrated approach, as we see in the food systems, from farm to fork, the whole value chain from production up to consumption level. And those of us that are in the food systems or in the agro-business, we always say that you must have the end in mind when you engage in food systems, because it's the quality in mind that you have and the destination that you have. Ensuring oversight across the entire food supply chain from production and processing to distribution, import and export. Importantly, dear colleagues, the bill provides a platform to improve risk communication, enforce compliance and build capacity among food handlers and institutions. By doing so, it will significantly contribute to minimizing emerging food safety threats, protecting public health and strengthening consumer confidence in the food system in the country. So this bill, therefore, has been considered internally in the ministry. We have a policy review in the ministry that is one of the platforms through which we ventilate through drafts that become available to the public. It has been endorsed for this consultative engagement and the subsequent engagements that we will have. So this underscores the importance of your input at this critical stage. So I like very much the constitution and the setup of this workshop, that you have experts from various institutions with various roles, and we all converge to understand the importance of food safety and how we would want these matters to be legislated, and to give therefore regard to the, and give effect to the provisions of the what we want to see. So the question that we always would want to ask is how it would look like when this bill is being implemented. Is it promoting the productive capacity and strengthening the food systems in the country? Is it ensuring that trade in the food industry and the agribusinesses is not constrained? How does the bill make sure that the governance aspects across the various institutions that have a stake in here, the governance mechanisms, the setting up of the Food Safety Council, for example, and the various committees, how that is effectively done in a manner that does not introduce unnecessary bureaucratic layers, but brings together the contributions of the various institutions and the thought process that is required to do so. Because governance and inclusion is always important, as we say, no one must be left behind. So over the next 2 days, you are invited to actively engage in the final proofreading of the bill and to provide your valuable inputs. Now, another stepping is welcome. So let us open it up. Let us provide those critical inputs that should be considered in the bill. That when we take this bill to the wider public stakeholder consultations, it should become effectively clear that yes, this bill has gone through thorough scrutiny. of a group of experts, ladies and gentlemen, from specialized institutions that have provided their input, and to the extent possible, those inputs are incorporated in the bill. So your expertise and perspectives are essential to ensuring that the legislation, eventual legislation, is robust, that is practical, and that is responsive to the current and the foreseeable future challenges. So I.
And now let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back shortly with Get More News. Please stay tuned.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Lipurane ngeno wapumbwa Eva Tere ulikoni maondo teto ingida ashike kapeno nwe odete opoye ekukulile. Oshafa fana nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana. Onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu konda doili nawa. Nune uto otukwetira o special angeta shake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka. Opone ushendife nawa nukumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge pata fano na Monica ko Eagle FM. Onore tatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile kongerewa, mura hetatu natu, bali o hetatu matatu, o mafelane, Eagle FM, the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if.
Welcome back. Now for some very interesting news. Afrexim Bank, $3 billion US dollar Walvis Bay fuel hub set to transform regional energy supply. Now, Namibia is poised to become a strategic energy gateway for Southern Africa, following plans by the African Export-Import Bank to finance a $3 billion US dollar fuel storage and distribution hub in Walvis Bay. Now, the project, developed in partnership with the Dangote Group, will see refined petroleum products shipped from Lagos to Walvis Bay before being distributed across the region, including Zimbabwe, Zambia, and Botswana. Once operational, the hub is expected to reduce fuel delivery times to as little as 5 days, a significant improvement from the current 2 to 3 weeks required for shipments from the Near East. Now, to support initial operations, Afrimex Bank plans to procure approximately 550 fuel trucks, while long-term infrastructure development will include pipeline networks linking multiple countries in the region. Discussions are already underway to extend the Beira-Massa pipeline into Zambia, further strengthening regional connectivity. Economically, the project could deliver substantial cost savings. Zambia currently spending about $2 billion US dollars annually on fuel imports, while Zimbabwe and Botswana each spent roughly $1 billion US dollar. Now, the new hub is expected to reduce this cost by improving logistics efficiency and supply reliability. In addition, integration with the Pan-African Payment and Settlement system could ease pressure on foreign currency reserves by enabling transactions in local currencies, potentially supporting currency stability across participating nations. Now, strategic positioning for Namibia is so that Namibia, the development position for Namibia, the development positions Walvisby as a key logistics and energy distribution center for Southern Africa. The project is expected to boost port activity, create jobs, and attract further investment into infrastructure and related industries. Now, as the region seeks more resilient and cost-effective energy supply chains, the Walvisby Fuel Hub could mark a significant step toward greater energy security and economic integration. Now, to discuss this on an economic aspect, we're now going to get hold of economist Gabriel Ninomenovery Erastus. Stay tuned for that.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa Eva tere ulikoni maondo toto ingida ashike kapeno nwe kutite opoye ekukurile oshafafana nongeshefa ili mehola mo ihoetike kovano ile koshiwana unongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa nune udo otukwetira o special angetashia kengeshefa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijamo ili nawa ninge Pata fanona, Monica ko Eagle FM, onore tatuimwe bali heali, nola natu, heali bali no heali. Ileko berewa, nora hetatu natu, bali o hetatu watatu, o mafelane, Eagle FM, the eye.
Okay, joining us in studio now telephonically is economist Ninomenovery Erastus. A very good afternoon to you, Gabriel, and welcome to On the Radar.
Yes, good afternoon to you, ma'am.
Yeah, we're discussing news that the type that you like to hear, having known you over time, and the content that you prefer is always when Namibia has news of this sort. That is the Afrimax Bank of $3 billion Walvisby Fuel Hub, which is set to transform a regional energy supply. Kind of get into what this means for Namibia, from an economics perspective. Obviously, as much as we feel that it's good news, we need to understand economically what does it actually mean for us.
Yeah, even though I was hoping that it's a refinery, but it still is okay. Looking at the whole plan, the whole plan of investing into it and the whole value and supply chain and the regional ambition, I think in the basic way that I can say, it's a big deal. In terms of the economic spillover and in terms of positioning Namibia as one of the logistical hub. So if you look at it where the thing or the storage is going to be positioned, and if you look at the ambition that it intended to supply the regional market, now go in between getting the fuel from Walvis Bay to take it to Zambia or to Botswana. That is where the benefit lies. So and that is where now, if we are to take up opportunity, if we are to look at how do we benefit from this, is to look now in between that. How do we make sure that the truck that take the fuel to Zambia is a Namibian truck? How do we make sure that the driver is a Namibian? How do we make sure that the servicing of the tractor is Namibian? How do we make sure that the spare part and where the truck is going to be stored is in Namibia? So it's about making sure that we derive the maximum value of it. And again, if we are going to build a pipe, who is going to construct the pipe? Are we ready to construct the pipe? So we have to make all these policy decisions and enabling decisions to make sure that we capture the value of what is coming, because the distance between the two is what matters.
Yeah.
And that is where the economic benefit will come from.
Interesting. And now, at this point, of course, you mentioned something quite interesting there, to see you're hoping it was a refinery. I think anybody else would be hoping that. And first thing came to my mind when I read this news was when Ali Dangote was in Namibia, somewhere last year when, President Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwah was inaugurated as president. But yeah, what about talks of actually a refinery? I mean, Dangote now is, because of the situation that is happening, on the global scale, fuel, Strait of Hormuz, now is positioning itself to producing even more at a higher capacity of barrels of oil. What about talks such as those, or perhaps maybe those would probably come in later? For now, we have to deal with, okay, being a port. That, what about maybe conversations of that? Is that something that could also might potentially work out in the future?
Yeah, in the future, definitely. As soon as we hear about the final investment decision of Total and others, then that conversation is going to come. It's going to be quite relevant. For now, we have already agreed to the storage. We have already agreed to the storage, and I'm sure because Dangote is one of the people that who stand that we cannot be importing things because we are exporting jobs.
Mm.
So definitely, as you can see, he built the refinery in his country, and he will not go do it elsewhere. But the most important part is that we still have space for us to think about the refinery. Storage is not something that can actually prevent us from that, because when you are refining, you also need to store. So that is still be another asset, because if we consider refinery once Total and others decide to extract, we're going to need a storage. So, and to such a level, it will be actually come in handy, because when you are going to refine, we have already a storage. We have already the infrastructure that are feeding the internal or the subject market. So I think if we can go ahead and go faster, then we get a positive financial investment decision from Total Energy and others. I think we can just actually move straight into refining. I think we can just find the investors that are willing to refine our crude, because crude will be now also be closer. Will be closer within our ocean, and it just actually to set up the infrastructure that is enabled to refining, and the storage is already closer. So it will align. It definitely will align once that financial investment decision is made. I think it will be easier even to move capital into it.
That's interesting. And of course, we see also a close relationship between Botswana and Namibia with, of course, I think a lot of, things poised, for the future, between the two countries. But now here we're talking about plans to procure approximately, 550 fuel trucks. And you speak about, some of the, if that's trucks, we're talking about, drivers, that is Namibian drivers, having their part to play in that. But then also, what about the long-term infrastructure development, which will include now the pipeline networks, linking multiple countries in the region? I think the question now is, so to say, Gabriel, what is or how can Namibia now ensure that its people really benefit from this?
Yeah, that is something that we always have been struggling with, ensuring that we benefit from massive investment like this. Remember, Dangote spoken on time. The news about the loan has been loud, has been said on time.
Yeah.
So the basic thing that we can do is already actually aligning our infrastructure. Because remember, if you look around, our roads are not have been positioned enough for us to have a lot of trucks. If you look at the accident that are happening between Arandes and Swakop, because there is no dual roads, you see. So our infrastructure in terms of roads are not positioned to take such type of advantage. Mm. Our rail infrastructure are not positioned to take such advantage. So we now, since these things are announced on time or in advance, we actually now have enough time to prepare. Ourselves, for our entrepreneurs, and for ourselves to take advantage. Because remember, that's what we say now, information is very, very important. And when you give it on time, when you announce it on time, you enable everybody to make a decision. So now Dangote has committed capital.
Yeah.
Dangote has committed capital. And they did it and announced it publicly that this is what we're going to do. So now it's for us to strategically now sit down, Transnamib, Minister of Work and Transport, the logistic sector, and all the policymakers to say, colleague, this is coming. And they got there, they wanted to export it to Botswana. They wanted to export it to Zambia. How do we get ready? And when Dangote is coming, we have already a blueprint that we have Namibian companies.
Mm-hmm.
Our truck capacity is at this level. While we are actually building or investing in our rail, we have already 20 trucks that are ready to distribute. We are already expanding the road between Okahanja until Oshikango to go in Angola, until Zambezi to go in Zambia, and we are also expanding from Hobabis to Botswana to take to Botswana. So we have to take advantage of this type of announcement so that we can prepare. Unlike now, you see what we are doing with the oil and gas. We are not doing anything.
Mm.
We are drafting a legislation, actually. But a legislation alone is not enough. But there are those ones who have taken this information very well. They are already training themselves. They are already getting certification, ISO certification to work in the ocean. They are already training themselves. But at the highest level, at the national level, we're not doing any much. If you look at it, one of the news that is that we only have two helicopter pilots in Namibia, or three or four. But if you look at where the oil rigs are, they are very far, which require helicopters. But there is no training institution which is doing the training to capacitate the pilot for helicopters to deliver things in the ocean. So we need now to learn a lesson that don't run to draft legislatures. Come up with a practical solution. Dangote has announced.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
mm-hmm.
How is the road to Zambia? The Zambian trucks are causing a mess in our road because our roads are too narrow. They are literally being a headache right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just COPPA, which is coming once a week or twice a week. Now imagine if it's full and Zambia decided, okay, cool, I'm going to procure from you Dangote, I need supply like this. You're going to have more trucks going to Zambia. But your road are already like this between Arandes and helicopters. I mean, and between Usakos and Sokobon is already a mess. It's already a mess. You cannot drive there because the road are narrow.
Yeah.
Now imagine between Okahanja and Chuarongo when you're going to Zambia. Now imagine now from Rundu to Zambezi. So this is announced on time. We get our infrastructure ready. We get our people ready. So we don't go like, no, the foreigners are coming. No. We get ourselves ready by understanding the value chain of what this is going to create.
And it will open more investment. It will open more investment.
So we have our policymakers have this tendency. The private sector should take advantage. There is no taking advantage if there is no enabling, if there are no public infrastructure. So you cannot go out there tell the private sector, Dangote now is coming, you guys take advantage. I cannot take advantage if the road to Zambia is narrow. I cannot take advantage if my truck is going to take 20 hours just to get to Botswana.
Yeah.
So it means that there are basic infrastructure that need to already being rolled out. So that means now the Minister of Work and Transport, by hearing this, they're already aligning their budget. They are already prioritizing the basic infrastructure, because for the rail, it might take a bit longer. But for the road, we cannot transport fuel to Zambia, to Botswana, and to Tanzania through the Tokanja or Chuarongo road. We can't. Which is already killing people. No, we can't.
Mm.
We cannot afford to add more than trucks in our roads the way they are. No.
Mm.
Unless
mm.
we have an infrastructure like the one between Venduk and Okahanja. Because there is no delay. The trucks are moving freely. There is no delay for me. There is no delay for you as a tourist. So these are the type of opportunity where we are not going to pray things happen like we are trying to pray away accidents. No, we have to start investing in the basic infrastructure. We have to start capacitating our people. We have to start coming up with the modality to regulate and to guide the movement of this stuff.
Being more practical on ground.
Yes, we have to be more proactive, because they did something that the Namibian people don't do. They have announced in advance that we have actually already got capital. We have spoken to your government has agreed. So it means prepare your construction companies. Prepare your who and who. So that when you're going to give out tenders, don't go say no local, prepare your people. It means also the training institutions, the UNAM, the NAST, the NIMT, the VTCs.
Yeah.
We now have to start preparing people who can work in constructing oil storage. Yes, we have a bit of capacity given the storage that we have built. Can we now gather them again? So those are the type of proactive action that we need to take rather than just waiting and waiting like we always do and pray and give long speeches for entrepreneurs to take advantage. You cannot take advantage when the platform are not well created to enable you. The word enabling is very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
It means the foundation need to be built where your local entrepreneur are going to sit on.
Yeah. Quite interesting, thought-provoking, contributing thoughts right there, you know, especially about the road. You know, as much as it gets exciting, 550 trucks on the road, wonderful. Economically, this is going to boost us.
We cannot even afford extra 100 on our road. We can't.
Mm, I hear you.
If you just look for the past 3 months or 4 months, almost every deadly accident, it involved a truck.
Yes.
It involved a truck. Now, if you add 100 more, what will happen? And if there is one thing I have, if you read one of the opinion pieces today in the village, it says because people are now afraid to go into the road during weekends because of trucks, it also means money is not moving. Now, the more dangerous your road become by adding extra 200 trucks, the more the tourists do not want to travel. The more I will not want to go to Crayfish Festival. The more I do not want to to go spend money. Because the road is dangerous. So you have to plan your infrastructure to make sure mobility is never affected. And mobility is the movement of goods and people at the same time. So you cannot enable trucks to move and you stop people from moving. Because when people are scared to, because of the trucks,
yeah,
they will stop moving. They will start stop spending money.
Yeah. You know,
so mobility have to be enabled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. While we're still on this conversation, from your perspective, with the way road accidents have drastically increased on our Namibian roads, and let's not say awareness is not being done. I think awareness is being done, and I think perhaps we need to move, still do awareness, but look at more other practical solutions. From your opinion, what is it that you think our authorities should do, and also bringing in the aspect of trucks? You rightly say that every accident, most of them, percentage of many of them that are happening, a truck was involved. So what is your suggestion that perhaps maybe we should be doing?
We need to stop being reactive. If you look at now, everybody's now reacting. We should do what? No. We said we want to position ourselves as a logistic hub, right?
Right.
Logistic is what? Logistic involves trucking. It involves movement of such a type of vehicle. So you have to put safety measures. You have to build the enabling infrastructure not to cause accidents. Like I said, every time I go to Swakop, this is something that I tell everybody. I don't know in whose mind the Swakop Mund road to Usakos to Okanja is not a double lane. Why? There is no other significant road stretch than that road. Everything that comes in Namibia, everything that leaves Namibia is through that road. So on your question, what we're supposed to do is first to understand. You have to understand how significant that the Swakop Mund road is on your economy. Then you do the necessary investment. Now we are just extending between, I think, Karibibe and Usakos. And we are just doing it now.
Mm.
And the Dangote is coming with 500 trucks. And that means more accident for you because you do not understand the significance of the investment which is coming. If you do not understand the significance of the investment that is coming, it means more accidents are going to happen because you have not prepared yourself. So this is, it does not require all this reactionary approach. No, we first need to understand what is coming, what is the magnitude of it, and what can we do to enable it to happen seamlessly. So yeah, we train our trucks in terms of defensive driving, in terms of what they need to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because right now, I can tell you, in our schools, in our training and whatever, there is no training, sir. Like, no, the truck drivers, they get a special training about Mm-mm. defensive, about anything. We have not actually make it as a national requirement. But now you are now going to have more trucks. And if you have no national policy or strategy in place on how your trucks that are going to move cargo around your country need to be trained or need to be capacitated, then again, it's going to be a bit problematic.
Quite interesting. I always appreciate your insights. You know.
So those are the moves that you have to start making for you to prepare for such type of now investment which are coming.
Indeed.
But first, understand the magnitude and the significance
of what's coming.
If you don't, you will not prepare for it. You will not prepare your people. You will not prepare your infrastructure either.
And that's true, even with so many investments that come our way. Mm. Yeah.
Yep.
Mm. You know, thank you so much for making time for us. It's a pleasure.
All right, ma'am.
Okay. And there we had it from Nina Menavery Erastus, an economist. And I want to see also somebody who gets to think critically over so many issues now for many of the articles that he covers. Please do ensure that you are subscribed to receive the Villager newspaper, which is out every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Today's e-paper is also out. Send a text message to 081-200-4144 and receive tri-weekly dose of social and economic news absolutely free of charge. Now, with that being said, let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. Of course, this is On the Radar News Analysis. Do stay tuned.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Our handle is Eagle FM Namibia.
Eagle FM, the eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud. So
not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Likurane ngeno wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweko tete opoye ekukurile. Oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo ihewe kike kovano ile koshiwana. Unongeshe faa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka okukwetera oipindi kono Honda doyinawa nune udo otukwetera o special ngetashake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijamo ili nawa ninge kwata fano na Monica ko Eagle FM onore tatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile konderewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu batatu o mafilane Eagle FM VI.
Welcome back, and now for some economic indicators before we head over to news beyond the borders of Namibia. $1 today is equal to 16 Namibian dollars, 0.31 cent. One United Arab Emirates dirham equals to 4 Namibian dollars, 0.44 cent. One Australian dollar is equal to 11 Namibian dollars, 0.82 cent. £1 sterling is equal to 22 Namibian dollars, 0.21 cent. And then €1 is equal to 19 Namibian dollars, 0.22 cent. One Chinese yuan is equal to 2 Namibian dollars, 0.39 cent. And lastly, on that, one Botswana pula is equal to 1 Namibian dollar and 22 cents. And now, let's go to news beyond the borders of Namibia. Starting off in South Africa, regarding heavy rains in parts of Little Karoo, Garden Route. And for those traveling to SA, be cautious.
To the Garden Route, where disaster management in the Garden Route District Municipality in the Western Cape say that all role players are on high alert following the Orange Level 8 warning for the region. Now, the South African Weather Services has warned of heavy rains as well as gale force winds, among other conditions, from today in the Central and Little Karoo, as well as other parts of the Garden Route. Let's speak now to SABC News reporter Tanya Krauser. Tanya, good morning. So just in terms of where you are and the weather conditions this morning, just bring us up to speed with that first, please.
Good morning, Sakina. Good morning, viewers. I am in George at the moment. I'm not sure if you can hear in the background. It is very rainy and windy, and it's cold. So we've been experiencing this rain since yesterday, but it really picked up from around 4 o'clock this morning. And at the moment, no major incidents have been reported so far, but the Meyrinspoort and the Swartberg Pass between Oudtshoorn and St. Albert has been closed. And the roads are just waterlogged. I've seen some roads in Nisna, a George Westrand, has been closed to traffic because of flooding.
Tanya, do you find that people are heeding the warnings that have been issued and also just taking caution and in terms of not going out unless they absolutely have to?
Yes, well, I've seen a lot of vehicles on the road, but I guess it's motorists that they need to get to work. But, you said earlier, schools are closed today in George, Nisna, and Oudtshoorn. So those people will be at home safe and sound. And basically, your people have just been urged not to travel unnecessarily, and also to bring the animals inside. So, so that everybody is just warm and comfortable in this horrible weather.
Mm. And Tanya, you've alluded to the wind and, of course, the cold, but we also heard there from the South African Weather Services expecting gale force winds at some point today. Any indication of that? And what sort of concerns would that bring with it for the region?
Yeah, the wind is picking up. It's not gale force yet, but we are expecting some more serious windy conditions during the day. Of course, that is a threat to infrastructure, especially informal settlements. At the moment, municipalities are assisting the residents there with sandbags and plastic sheets. But of course, everybody just needs to prepare for more serious conditions during the day.
Tanya Krauser, thank you so much for that update from George there in the Western Cape.
Meanwhile, every now and then South Africa seems to be reporting on drug-related
Esira shisho, oyotari kukwathere opovuro kara uasira ya kweni ochisho. Watuchi itana basic mental health first aid course. Haiganjua oshari chamhongi kwa mboka ili iyo yo NHP. Watapewa nongo nonseo na hene una okutongorora omadidiriko ugopetameko yena sha nupiakadhi nenge omathidakano gopama viraviro kuchane omokatiko kumekoe nenge anironga pamwe nangoe osho otopewa unongo kene una okuya kwathera nukuya pa eabidido yiri mwanjira omanga upya kadiboka inauru darara kuyerere ounji na kene unokana uishangitha tarira po epanja yao yo nhp.com.na epangono maradura sano odovina okurandurwa NHP rooted in care for you
your health, your life, your peace of mind NHP, we're about you.
So in South Africa, now 13 million rand worth of drugs were found in Durban.
13 million rand worth of drugs destined for Gauteng was allegedly found in Durban. But for more on this, let's speak to the KZN police spokesperson, Colonel Robert Netyunda. Colonel Netyunda, thanks so much for your time. Welcome to Morning Live. If you could just give us, indication of exactly what happened and also just confirm for us whether it was in fact 13 million rand worth of drugs and where it was found.
The operation started in middle of April, when there was a drug consignment which was recovered in Gauteng province. And from that point, it was found that the drugs got into the country via the Durban hub. That's where intelligence was activated to track and monitor citizen vessels which were coming from the South American country, which you can name for now, pending further investigations. And in those vessels, one of them, which was transporting buses into the country, was flagged. And in one of the buses, that's where the bricks of cocaine, 52 of them, were found hidden in the air-conditioning compartment of that bus.
Colonel Netyunda, have there been any arrests effected in this regard?
The shipment had nobody in it, and as police, we are tracking where it comes from and also where it was destined. We are hopeful that the intended recipient will be uncovered and will be duly taken into account. They will explain. Because the buses were going to a company, so we'd like to find out if the police is whoever ordered the bus knew that the buses were coming with a consignment of drugs, or somebody in between the shipment had his own motives in using the same shipment into the country. However, if police, we keep our cars closed so that we do not reveal too much when it's still too early. We just found the drugs yesterday evening, so we would like to first get done with the business, investigate, follow intelligence, check where the bus come from and where they were going. And we believe that we'll be able to uncover who are the people behind these drugs.
And just a final one. This comes, of course, at a time, Colonel Netyunda, when we are listening to evidence at the Madlanga Commission talking about a similar story of drugs that were smuggled through the port in KZN and, of course, subsequently went missing. And we listened yesterday in detail to Major General Flynn explain how processes in a specific case were actually flaunted. Are you satisfied as the police that you have followed the correct protocols in securing this bust of cocaine that we are talking about?
The drugs were secured and we followed every principle to the T. What's happening in the commission is also a lesson that within the service could be people with ulterior motives. And it's always safe for police to guard against external and internal challenges that my temper was evident. What we can say for now is that the drugs recovered are safe and they will be taken to the right channels to ensure that they become evident when it's time to go to court. And they will be destroyed in the right way at the right time.
Well, thank you so much. And that, of course, Colonel Robert Nechiyunda.
Meanwhile, South Africa's Civil Aviation Authority hosts National Aviation Conference 2026.
The South African Civil Aviation Authority is hosting the National Aviation Conference 2026. We look at the impact of high-cost jet fuel on the aviation industry. SABC News economics reporter Katlego Lekgode is there and joins us live with the very latest. A very good morning to you, Katlego. Most certainly, the cost of jet fuel would be the biggest talking point right now, and as much as they would have wanted to talk about safety issues and other gains and where they're still lacking and how they improve, but it seems as though jet fuel and its cost would now become the focal point given what's happening in the Middle East. Just share with us what else is expected to be ventilated or discussed at the conference.
A very good morning to you, Mfundo, and to our viewers at home. You're right. Topical issues expected to get under the spotlight today as we mark the first day of the two-day National Aviation Conference underway in Kempton Park. There are a variety of issues that we're expecting to really be on the program here, a chock-a-blocked program that just got underway now. You know very well that South Africa has been ranked as one of the safest jurisdictions when it comes to aviation, but there are a number of issues, a number of challenges, be it geopolitics, the issue of artificial intelligence, safety and security, and the latest being the issue of jet fuel that has had a lot of those in the industry really worried about what is really is to happen to this sector. You know very well that it's a very pivotal sector when you talk about the airline economy. And this morning, we're going to bring into the conversation the South African Civil Aviation Authority. They are the ones that invited us here together with the Department of Transport to look at various of these issues. And the issue of jet fuel is really going to be topical here. We're expecting as well in the coming 2 days for the Minister, Barbara Creasy, to form part of those discussions as we push for solutions. Pindiwe Gwebu, thank you very much for joining us on the SABC. Take us through what we can expect in the 2 days. And really, I suspect that the issue of jet fuel and the shortage therein becomes a topical one. Welcome.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having us. What's going to be happening in the next 2 days is that we are embarking on a dialogue together with the industry where we will be dealing with a number of topical issues that are facing the aviation industry today. Some of those, in fact, the theme for these 2 days is innovation for a sustainable aviation sector. So you would know that over the past few years, aviation has faced a number of changes, most of those impacted by technology, the advancement of technology. So what we have in our program today is also going to talk about, we also have a speaker from the African Civil Aviation Commission, who's also going to talk to us in terms of what are the solutions that the African continent is looking at in terms of sustainable aviation fuel. As you know, that there is a rise in the price of fuel as a result of the geopolitical tensions that are currently taking place around us. We are not immune to this as the African continent and certainly not as South Africa. And therefore, it then brings the timeliness of the discussions about sustainable aviation fuel to say, what is it that we can offer as a solution to the industry, looking also at the environmental impact of our activities as the civil aviation industry on the environment. We're also going to be looking at the impact of artificial intelligence to the topic of safety, security, environment, and so on. So we do have an expert that is going to be talking to us exactly on this. But as we know, whenever you introduce technology, you are facing immediately a new risk, which is cyber threats, cyber security. And in our program, we also have got experts that are going to be debating on this, that are going to be presenting on how well we can basically manage issues of cyber threats in civil aviation. As you know, we've got a number of examples that have taken place across the globe where the aviation industry has been directly impacted by cyber attacks. And also, we are going to be looking at again, the issue of safety. How are we doing as South Africa from a safety perspective? I mean, South Africa has been impeccable in terms of making sure that there are zero fatal accidents in the airline sector, in our space, in our skies. And we want to repeat this also when it comes to general aviation. And the Director of Civil Aviation today would also, as well as the Minister tomorrow, will also emphasize on this. We're doing well in terms of reducing the number of accidents in general aviation. However, that picture is not necessarily that rosy when we look at the number of fatal accidents and the number of fatalities. And so our interest in these 2 days is to make sure that the conversation centers around what are the workable solutions, practical solutions that we can introduce as the aviation sector. What we've done very well in South Africa is that we've partnered with our industry. So the solutions that we are putting forward are not just coming from the regulator or the Department of Transport, but it's solutions that have been conceptualized with the industry. So we believe that the partnerships that we are forming, the collaboration between the regulator, government, and industry is quite critical and central in ensuring that the South African airspace is really performing well.
Yeah, Pindiwe, I have to let you go, but the issue also of the adverse weather conditions, the issue of infrastructure in the skies, I mean, that also becomes a topical issue looking at what has been happening in various of the provinces, the harsh weather conditions. Are we planning in line with that as well?
Definitely. We do have an expert speaker as well that will be talking to us on MET issues, issues related to weather, issues related to the advancements even in that part of our industry. And so we're looking forward to that. Yes, infrastructural issues are also going to be discussed in the 2 days by various of our panels. And so we are looking forward to what they are going to be putting forward. We are keeping an open mind, and what we want to walk away with from these 2 days are solutions that are implementable, solutions that are going to make a difference in ensuring safety and security in civil aviation in South Africa.
Pindiwe Gwebu, thank you very much for your time. The program getting underway, the national anthem was just sang a moment ago, and we are expecting as well before we're expecting the Minister Barbara Creecy, to give a closing address here tomorrow. But a number of those speakers are already here from either your airlines or the associations, and we are expecting 36 speakers to form part of those that will thresh these conversations as they inch towards solutions, as you had Pindiwe Gwebu there coming through and joining us from the South African Civil Aviation Authority.
Conflict in Iran disrupts DRC Congo's copper and cobalt mining.
The Democratic Republic of Congo is the world's largest producer of cobalt, accounting for 70% of global output. The mineral is essential for making rechargeable batteries used in smartphones, laptops, and electric vehicles. But production is now being affected by the ongoing conflict in the Middle East. Mining companies heavily rely on imported sulfur-based chemicals to extract and process the minerals. But more than 3,000 tons of these inputs have reportedly been cancelled or delayed due to disruptions in global shipping routes.
The mining industry depends heavily on fuel and other chemical inputs required for cobalt processing, all of which are imported. Therefore, the closure of the Strait of Hormuz is significantly impacting the mining industry.
Some mining firms have already scaled back operations due to rising transport and input costs. Authorities say rerouted shipments through Tanzania's Dar es Salaam port have nearly doubled since the conflict began. Local firms say they are feeling the pressure.
No production à nous local.
Our local production in the DRC and many other African countries relies on imported inputs, such as chemicals and other supplies that power factories and industries. Consequently, when international market prices rise, it's reflected here at home.
As tensions between the United States, Israel, and Iran continue to ripple through global markets, Congo's copper and cobalt miners are paying more for the chemicals needed to keep production running.
The logistical challenges in supplying chemicals used for processing copper and cobalt have affected the production of critical minerals. The minerals generate much-needed revenue for the DRC economy, which the conflict in the East has seriously affected. Chris Ochamringa, CGTN, Kinshasa, Democratic Republic of Congo.
Meanwhile, experts seize opportunities for Kenyan manufacturing under the Chinese zero-tariff policy.
Let's bring in Anthony Mwangi, who's the CEO of Visible Industries. He's also the former chief executive of the Manufacturing Sector Lobby Group. That's the Kenyan Association of Manufacturers. Welcome to the program, Anthony. Before we get into this, though, I'd like your thoughts on the performance of Kenya's manufacturing sector last year. It grew at a much smaller pace, 2% versus 3% the year before. Its share of GDP also contracted quite a bit, 7.1% in 2025 compared to 7.3% in 2024. What explains what happened there?
Thank you, Ramanyang. Thank you for having me. And as you've said, it's consistent with what you've seen, the trend you've seen over the last 10 years, because the manufacturing contribution to GDP has been declining consistently from the highs of 10 in 2010, 2012, now to 7.1%, as you have mentioned, largely because some sectors like services and telcos and banking have been growing faster. However, if you look at the growth, as you mentioned, in 2023, in 2024, and 2025, at 3% and 2% this year, that is near stagnation. And if you just want to crack that in numbers, the Kenya GDP is about neighborhood of $135 billion. So 7%, 0.1% is a range of about $10 billion. So the growth this year is only about $200 million. And you can see that is really, really minimal growth. If you compare that with Tanzania, it's around 4.8%. If you compare with Ethiopia, it's about 10%. If you compare with Egypt, it's about 14%. So it is disappointing, but it's consistent with what has been happening for the last 10 years.
So this market access window is now open, effective from the 1st of May. We can export just about anything, right, into the Chinese market duty-free. What part of Kenya's manufacturing sector stands to benefit the most, at least immediately? Is it the agro-processing and the food part of the manufacturing sector?
I think you're right. What will seem to be have first mover's advantage would be agro-processing, so agriculture supporting agriculture. And I think significant work has been done. Avocado, for instance, macadamia has been growing, and we expect to see more products growing. But as you, and that's leading on the positive side. But I think the downside of that is that, Kenya doesn't necessarily have a market problem. It is good to have that open, zero tariff market. But we don't have a market problem. We have EU, Kenya EU EPA. We have AGOA, even though we have 10% escalation of tariffs. We have AFCFTA, we have COMESA, we have EAC. We've not been able to serve those markets effectively. So Chinese market, although good, and you will see some of the crops like coffee and perhaps, specialty teas, out apart from CTC, so we have orthodox teas that could be able to be exported. But still, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. There's heavy lifting that needs to be done.
So tell us about that. Is it a productivity problem? Is it a competitiveness problem? Because I know one of the key things that when we speak to manufacturers and we speak to members of KM, one of the things that always keeps coming up is, look, the cost of energy in this country is way higher vis-a-vis South Africa, vis-a-vis Egypt, and that in turn limits the competitiveness of whatever you can manufacture and then put into the export market.
First of all, this zero tariff regime, affects, or impacts all 53 countries in Africa. And therefore, Kenya will not be alone. We'll be competing with everyone, and also we'll be competing with the region, Vietnam, the Cambodians, and Malaysia, and others. So our industrial competitiveness has always been a drag to Kenya. And I think that is a major, major challenge. If you look at the cost of power and you just compare with the neighbors, Tanzania, Ethiopia, Egypt, Kenya is about twice the cost of power that Tanzania enjoys. It's about 4 to 5 times what Ethiopians are paying. It's about 6 to 8 times what Egyptians are paying. And therefore, from that standpoint, we already have a challenge of competitiveness. Then we have a very complex tax code that is changed every year through finance bill. So we don't have a very consistent industrial policy. If you look at Ethiopia, for instance, or Egypt, for instance, they have very, very consistent and very robust export regimes, especially in Egypt. And Ethiopia, you know, in terms of industrial policy, ours seems to be a moving target. It seems to be changed, tweaked every year through the finance bills, and that will put us on a back burner, and especially when you're competing with all the 53 countries. And remember, Kenya doesn't have the minerals to export at the moment, so we can only compete on manufactured goods, and that is going to be a tall order.
We're smack in the middle now of actually the very thing that you pointed out there, the finance bill of 2026, which will cover the next fiscal year, running from July this year to June 2027. We're in the middle of debating that at the moment. What policy changes would you like to see as someone who's lobbied for the manufacturing sector in the past?
You know, unfortunately, most of the items, you know, within the finance bill are always about tweaking here and there. We don't seem to go for robust, comprehensive review and attack the real elephant in the room. So we tend to focus mostly on tax administration procedures and, you know, a few tweaks here and there. But we haven't seen a robust review, a robust, you know, really overhaul of industrial policy. So I'm less optimistic about what you expect. It has just been released. I've not gone through the whole document. But in a nutshell, what we'd like to see for us to be able to tweak and change the trajectory of the contribution to GDP by manufacturing sector is, number one, we have to be competitive. And in competitive, we mean that the industrial inputs and policies have to be robust. We have to look at what our neighbors are doing. We have to look at what the world is doing to be able, and it's not a difficult thing. So we have to do an overhaul industrial policy. We have to deal with the moving target that we call the tax regime. We have to deal with policy and regulatory overreach that we see by the government. So there's a lot of things that we need to do. And you can see even for access to capital, which has been going down for the industrial sector or manufacturing sector.
Right.
We're competing with government in the marketplace. So there are many things, but those I think are the most four that I see.
Indeed. And of course, if you're competing with the states, they're coming into the market borrowing at 8-9%. I mean, obviously, banks would prefer to lend to them rather than to manufacturing enterprises. One last question for you. From your perspective, from the perspective of manufacturing companies here in Kenya, what are the potential downside risks of this zero tariff policy?
As I mentioned, you know, earlier, we don't have a market problem, really. We have a production problem. And therefore, it is possible that we're not going to utilize that zero tariff as it were. We have, you know, an agreement with EU. We have had an agreement with the US through AGOA that we only implemented less than 1%. So for me, I think the biggest challenge that we see here, that I see, is that underutilization or very minimal utilization of our policy. And then what is the downside? When we hear about free market access, it comes with strings attached. It comes with other, you know, demands from those countries. And therefore, my worry is that what is it that we're going to provide? I understand there's going to be a two-year window. And therefore, still a bit of uncertainty there, what happens after 2 years. However, I tend to think that we are basically opening also the African market to Chinese manufacturers who will come, produce from here, and export. And that necessarily is not a problem. But for local Kenyans, it's going to be also very difficult to be able to meet the SPS standards, like the sanitary and phytosanitary standards, labeling, which has to be done in alignment with Chinese requirements, including Chinese language. So there are quite a lot of non-tariff barriers, even though the headline is zero tariff.
And now let's talk about financing East Africa's $20 billion US refinery ambition.
Where East African countries are talking about plans for building a joint oil refinery in Tanzania's northeast around the port of Tanga, effectively modeled after Nigeria's Dangote plant. East Africa currently imports virtually all of its refined petroleum products, mainly from the Middle East, and that leaves the region vulnerable to supply disruptions and price spikes, as we've seen now in the economic fallout from Israel and the United States' war on Iran. At a conference on infrastructure financing in the Kenyan capital, the country's president and Uganda's head of state, Yoweri Kaguta Museveni, signaled their support for the construction of a refinery. Africa's richest man, Aliko Dangote, was also at that event, said he could effectively replicate that 650,000-barrel-a-day refinery in East Africa, provided that governments in the region did support the initiative. Let's bring in Wangari Mwikia for this conversation. She's an economist and the managing director at Expertise Global. Wangari, good to have you on the program tonight. That 650,000-barrel-a-day refinery in Nigeria, that cost Aliko Dangote $20 billion to build. Given how much debt we see on public balance sheets in East Africa, what are Kenya's, Uganda's and Tanzania's options to finance that construction?
Well, the refinery is likely going to be financed through some sort of blended approach. And this is a similar approach to what the Dangote refinery also did. They had a mixture of equity, they had syndicated loans, and they had commercial loans. And they also had some involvement from the Afriexim Bank. So I think my expectation is that in East Africa, the countries are going to pursue some special purpose vehicle with a similar mix. And with support from Afriexim Bank and additional support through the Africa Finance Corporation that has shown significant interest. And also, this is quite important for things like providing credit enhancements, providing guarantees to ensure that this works out well. From a public finance perspective, it's important that this kind of infrastructure, this investment, doesn't leak into the current heavy debt burden that the countries face. And so this kind of blended financial arrangement will be vital to ensure that we don't have leakages and further constraints into the public budgets. An example for which Kenya might have some advantage is that they've recently instituted the National Infrastructure Fund, which I expect will be a critical player and a critical facilitator for this, especially for Kenya.
So Kenya did have a refinery, right, which it decommissioned over a decade ago. So from the outside, I guess some viewers will look at this and say, what's the economic logic of building an entirely new facility rather than refurbishing and upgrading the refinery that already exists in Changamwe, which potentially might cost less?
Well, you know, it's not true that it would cost less, because if you look at the Changamwe refinery, it's very old. It was, I think, about 10 years old. So you can imagine fuel refinery technical specifications have increased by many times since then. And even the structure of Changamwe, I think it was producing about 90,000 barrels per day. And that is only a small percentage of the proposed output for the Dangote refineries. So if we went the Changamwe refinery route, you'd be using old technology, which you have to upgrade anyway. You'd be compromising operations, and you'd have to expand operations. And then also you'd have to ensure that the technical specifications are up to par. And honestly, this is going to cost just as much as probably creating a new refinery. So the other considerations is that, you know, the Dangote refinery is going to be getting oil from different countries, South Sudan, Kenya, and Uganda. And these primarily, countries have vastly different types of crude oil. Uganda, it's much heavier, it's much more waxy, so it needs a lot of heating. And the others are more heavier, so they need separate heating. And so to create these kind of specifications is going to take a lot of financing. And so, and it will just be much simpler to have a brand new refinery and not use the old refinery in Changamwe.
This would also not just be about building a refinery, right? Because we're also talking about building the associated pipelines and storage facilities and so on and so forth, wouldn't we?
Yes, you are absolutely correct with that one. You know, a refinery needs upstream and downstream operations. You need the feedstock, which is the crude oil coming from the different countries. What does this mean? It means creating or using pipelines and refurbishing pipelines to the new refinery, but most likely creating new pipelines. Now, of the three countries, South Sudan is actually the highest producer of oil. But as you know, South Sudan, there's a lot of risk because the infrastructure has been affected a lot by the war. So it would need to be upgraded. And then to get down from Sudan to Tanzania, you would likely have to pass the Sud marshland, which is a big ecological zone within South Sudan. And passing that marshland is very, very technically difficult. You know, it's wet and, you know, the pipeline would be subject to corrosion. And, you know, pipelines don't like that. Pipelines like dry, stable conditions. You know, you would also, if there was a leakage, you know, the Sud marshland is a big carbon sink and globally important. So if there was a leakage, you can imagine the devastation of the Sud marshlands. And then also in terms of routing, you know, so there are considerations from that front. From a storage perspective, you know, the refinery would have its own storage facilities, and each country also have its own storage facilities. So those also would have to be taken into consideration, although those are already in place. So creating a refinery is not just the simple act of just creating and refining the oil. You need, you know, even the wastage that comes from refining oil is important to think about. You know, where you're going to put the wastage that comes from oil production, and what are the environmental and community implications. And those, as you know, are imperative and of high scrutiny globally. So there's a lot of considerations than just refining the oil.
Indeed. One last question for you. Because when Aliko Dangote built this the 650,000 barrel a day facility in Lagos, he said it was built without government incentives. I've heard this being described as effectively one-man industrial national policy. But when he says, as he did earlier this week, that construction of this refinery in East Africa is contingent on support from the region's government, what kind of support would be needed here?
Well, you know, when Dangote did his refinery in Nigeria, he was essentially just dealing with Nigeria. Here we're talking about South Sudan, Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, and potentially, you know, the supply to all the neighboring regions, all the way down to South Africa. This is literally about $1 million a day, a million barrels per day demand. And Dangote's refinery is going to be providing about 650 barrels per day, a very significant proportion. But you think about it, there's already an infrastructure of oil provision, right? So the geopolitics, the global geopolitics.
And with that, we come to the conclusion of today's episode of On the Radar News Analysis. Please do stay tuned for the Onkonana Dini program brought to you by Penny Ambeko. Join us from Indafa. Happy Jeju. It is goodbye. See you again tomorrow. Same time, same place.